Hello.
So are we ready or? Okay. So is it light up here? So much for dimming. Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dwayne Hart. I'm here to give a presentation on migrating from Linux to FreeBSD as a back-end data store. Roughly about 2 years ago, I rejoined the systems group that is tasked with maintaining the Department of Computer Science and Math and Stats at Memorial. In Math and Stats, we had, at the time, three research file servers and one departmental file server. The departmental file server had a backup on-site and off-site. Off-site being another location within the university, making use of a gigabit backbone, which has since been upgraded to 10 gig, and there's a funny story in that at a later point in time. However, the research file servers only had backups that were maintained for about a 24-hour window. And in my humble opinion, that was insufficient. So the whole storyline is what I did to rectify that situation. So the research and file backup servers had the following specs. It was an IBM X3500 dual core, had an IBM serve RAID card, 4 gigs of RAM, and it could contain 8 SATA drives. The drives were SATA 2, you know, fast throughput. That was high technology back in 2007, but now this is 2013, so we're a bit behind the scene. So the backup file servers had the following hard drive layout. Software RAID configuration, the OS partitions were installed on 2 RAID 1s and the data on 2 RAID 5s. So MD0 and MD1 was root and var, MD2 and 3 was the data file systems. Now, unfortunately, this was done after I had left the university the first time. The drives were sliced, so there was 6 on, you know, on one set, 8 overlapping the original 6 plus the OS disks, and that kind of caused a problem. So the OS layout, with trying to manage systems between 2 departments plus a third, we had come up with our own management system, which was a vision that our manager had brought to us, and we went about implementing the framework, and that's based on Python and JavaScript and a few other languages as well. But to try to stay uniform, both the research and the backup file server for this particular group had the following data sizes. So roughly we were looking at about 2.5 terabytes of disk space that we had to back up at some point. Now, if you please interrupt if you have any questions or what have you. The more I engage with you, the better the tutorial or the talk will be. So some of the issues, due to the physical layout of the drives, it was easy to repair or replace a drive if a drive had failed. We were using OpenNMS in monitoring our systems. But in order to replace a drive, we'd have to take the file server down, schedule an outage, bring the file server down, replace the drive, bring the machine up, get into the RAID card's BIOS, and integrate that drive as a JBOD so that when the system fully came up, we would be able to take that disk, partition it the way that we wanted to, slice it up, and then reintegrate it into the various RAID arrays that were degraded. Now, in saying that, once we brought the RAID or the drive back into whatever RAID had failed, we had performance issues while the drive was being reintegrated into the system. And people, when trying to use the system, launch new processes and what have you, were hindered by this. So we were trying to figure out a way to you know, keep them running on a faster I/O. Also, being 2013, 2014, we wanted to move away from 32-bit operating systems, but Linux as a whole, and I know FreeBSD doesn't, this is more of an IBM HPUX situation where you could change an OS syscontrol flag, reboot, and you'd come up on a new platform. Not very ideal. We'd need to take the file server, bring it down, bring it up in a diskless environment, and then perform a bare metal install of the OS onto the disks, and then go from there. So it was a bit time consuming. You were looking at about 4 to 6 hours, depending on the data and how far it had to transmit from. So a working solution, instead of going with a traditional disk pool system where the OS was on part of the drives. I wanted to go do a diskless FreeBSD install. Excuse me, so we would be able to leverage all the installed drives. So instead of just using six or six dot whatever drives that were previously engaged with under Linux, we'd be able to use the full eight. And in order to do that, we elected to go with the diskless install. And I know Michael Lucas had talked about, anybody purchased the Absolute FreeBSD textbook? No? One? Okay. I have one, a copy. And he mentions the fringe. So this is doing the fringe operating system type thing. So we got our FreeBSD diskless instance. We wanted a FreeBSD app server or a standalone standard server that would be the host for this client. And then we would implement ISTGT to create iSCSI targets that would be presented to our 64-bit Gen 2 Linux servers and act as our NFS gateways. And we'd be able to leverage Raccoon and AutoFS in order to run IPsec and essentially NFS4 and not have anybody eavesdrop on our communications. So if they got partway, they only got scrambled comms. So, and the other driving point was, the research group may be expanding their data sets at some later point in time. How do we integrate these new data volumes quickly and as efficiently as possible? So going with this diskless implementation would allow us to leverage that benefit in the framework. I've run diskless FreeBSD on 100 full duplex network, gigabit network, and have not had issues. I'm looking forward to going 10 gig when the budget permits me. But that's probably a year out. So we talked about that. And the other aspect is the 500 gig SATA 2 drives purchased back in 2007 have been dropping off like flies since. We invested some money, purchased 1 terabyte SATA 2 disks, and installed those. Unfortunately, due to a missing firmware upgrade, the IBM RAID serve card could only support a terabyte drive. I tried it with the 2 terabyte and it didn't go. I didn't have any 1.5 terabytes and I didn't want to invest any extra money, but I knew the terabytes would work because we had some in stock. So the FreeBSD server, just a common setup with ISE, DHCPD, TFTP, NFS, and I'm not sure if any of you were here last year. I had given a talk on Tales from the North, System Administration of a Geographically Dispersed Network. Most of that framework was discussed in that talk. And I'd like to point out that in our department, we're trying to optimize the existing infrastructure and new components by leveraging newer technologies. And we were not getting, for our core systems, did you want to run DNS on a quad core or an 8-core Xeon processor? It's kind of boggles my mind to invest that high end of hardware into such a back end resource for us. So what we did was some of our Supermicro cases that came in, I installed Zen server and created Zen clients and had FreeBSD installed on those. So the server itself had 16 cores, 32 gigs of RAM, and it was had a local disk store of 3 terabytes in a RAID 1 configuration. We carved that up to for a single host and multiple compute nodes, and ran our FreeBSD server or boot server on it. The computer that was off-site located in computer science, I repurposed a Dell Optiplex 755 with 3 gigs of RAM, RAID 1 or mirrored, G-mirrored OS disks, 500 gigs, and allocated it over there for the other backup server so that it could go in diskless mode. Once I had the diskless component, the backup server component configured, I then ran backup scripts so that I could have a window, a week's window of backup so that in the event that when we did the upgrade to the primary production server, we'd be able to fall back and get the data. So that's that component. Has anybody done diskless BSD or FreeBSD? Just yourself? 1, 2? Okay, 3? You know how versatile booting your clients can be. You just alter 2 specific lines in the dhcpd.conf line, and that being the file name, so that the TFTP knows what bootloader to hand out, and then the root path. So, you know, as long as you had diskless, or for myself, I followed this directory structure, diskless FreeBSD 9.3 version and the platform. You could go 10, you could have a 9.3p or whatever for patching, and then you could kind of roll out your upgrades to your diskless clients and having minimal downtime without having to perform a bare metal OS installation every time. So once you restarted a service, you restarted a client, the client came up, it was running that new OS or the patched version, depending on what you had defined in your configuration. Now, so I'll give you a little spec with regards to that Citrix instance, the Zen client. It was running on a Xeon E3 with 2 cores attached to that VM, with 1 gig of RAM and the 500 gig VDI or virtual disk on the local system with UFS 2 file system with journaling engaged. It's just mind-boggling that for my situation that, you know, this kind of setup was a bit of overkill. I didn't need to have that. The driving force was more on the client machine that was going to engage the data stores for us. And this was the specs for the computer science system. Now, how many of you are making use of ISTGT or iSCSI targets on BSD? Okay. So it's quite easy to implement. You install from ports. There's 3 files that you have to be concerned with. The first being the auth flag, or auth.conf. That's where you set up your 2 authorization accounts so that you can use CHAP. So I set up a username and a password, 12 characters in length. Used PWGen to generate my passwords and just set them off that way. Then the istgtcontrol.conf file, that was where you set up for the internal control of that daemon on that particular server. Fortunately, the font's a bit small. The istgt.conf file actually describes how to set up the iSCSI targets. So for my instance, I had a ZFS volume for Linux file server with an IDIS 0, and then I had defined the auth group and previously in that auth.conf file that had the username and password. I also set up the portal information. And what else is interesting? The target name. So this is a reverse fully qualified domain name with, I put in 2012-05. That was when I rejoined the department, but I probably should have put in the DNS registration date for math and stats. But, you know, I was the driving force on this one. I had CHAP auth method implemented so that it was both on the sender and the receiver, so that communications was encrypted as much as possible. And then I had my alias set up, which is pretty cool. So that was on the distless side. So then, you know, how many of you guys use ZatFS? 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, 5. So it's getting out there. So use the ZatFS create the storage to create the storage volume. Then I used the command truncate to create a 5 terabyte sparse file, and ran the one start on the ISTGT daemon so that in the event anything happened, whether the client rebooted or there was a disk trouble, I could come into the server room and engage the server to find out what actually took place, because it's still, in my humble opinion, the way I was implementing the solution, still beta. You know, I still wanted to make sure that everything was running, that, you know, I had full confidence in the framework. So then to check if the client had, the diskless client had rebooted, what's the best way of finding out if you had a disk failure or what have you, run it as zadpool import storage. And from there, you could do a zpool status and check the status of the drives. Unfortunately, at the time, I later had found a port that would allow me to query the IBM RAID serve card. And we only had the one card in the system, so it was rather trivial to get the information. But I didn't see examples within the documentation on how to engage the RAID card. So it might be possible to set up these individual drives in a JBOD manner without having to go into that RAID utility. But that would save a bit of time, but you know, it's hit and miss. So we, because it was a production, testing. Cool. All right, we're good to go. Mercy. Can you hear me now? All right, I'm going to turn it off again. Can you hear me now? Excellent. So we had, you know, we're trying to minimize our disk failures and what have you. I did suffer under Linux, we had a RAID 5 configuration. I did suffer a 2-disk failure simultaneously. We lost a good bit of research. I, you know, when you have the resources to implement, go with a RAID 6, or make sure your backup can go into production rather quickly. So I've essentially resigned myself to say, yeah, all right, we're in production. That is a primary component. We're going to do a RAID 6 configuration. So it was essentially an N minus 2 times the size of the disk in order to do a rough calculation of space. On this slide, you'll see that the last time I re-silvered was back in January, and it took about 3 hours to run. It starts out fairly slowly, and it was indicating it was going to take about 24 plus hours to complete. And then as it picked up, the time got a lot smaller. And it's interesting. We did have a performance hit. It did impact the research, but it was a lot faster recovering than just a standalone Linux installation. So I had that to go on. So that was production. The backup, I went with a RAID 5, thinking that when the budget permitted, we'd invest new infrastructure and migrate our backup to a proper system. So that was a ZFS V1. But the client configuration was the same. So we built once, rsynced our information from one app server to the other to keep that in line. So we had offsite backup there and then proceeded with that kind of setup. Then once we had our framework working, we did an rsync delta and implemented ZFS snapshots. And instead of a 24-hour window, we now had 32 days. So the researcher had more time to discover, oh, something went wrong, I can go back and get whatever data that was accidentally taken out. Now, for setting up the Linux file server, it's a little bit easier than the FreeBSD component. There's only two configuration files and a daemon to start up. And in the initiator.iscsi, it's just the fully qualified host name reversed again for the machine that the iscsi daemon would be running on. The iscsi.d.com file contained the auth method, so chap, I forget the other two options. And I had set it up for both the discovery and the data menu, or the data for the client. For the discovery, I set up the username discover and would use that template for the other clients to be able to chat with the iSCSI target host to see what disks would be available for that group, and then set up a special Linux file server with the password so that it could speak and get access to its own disk or iDisk target on the BSD backend. The node.startup, it's either manual or auto. Because I was I had tight control over the FreeBSD box and had that set up so that I had to manually engage the volumes, I went with a manual startup for the iSCSI daemon because, if that started automatically, it would try to reach out to the FreeBSD server to get its iSCSI target, and it wouldn't get it. And I didn't want the system to go into an awkward state. So once you had the daemon configured and running, you could then use the iSCSI admin discovery command to reach out to whatever backend that you had set up to find out what disks were available. I should have had the return output on these slides for you, for those that hadn't used iSCSI before. And then this line here was the actual login method. So it went and used chap auth to get the access to the disks. And once that was done, once it had successfully returned after authentication, you could then query the under Linux proc partitions or the kernel buffer, kernel ring buffer using the dmessage command and find out what actual device was attached from that. In our situation, we had dev SDC. We used the entire disk, the 5 terabyte disk, that iSCSI disk that we had set up with a ext4 file system. Then we used the bind command and then mounted up the user's math research file system 1 to this NFS4 share and restarted NFS if it hadn't been launched previously. And at that point, our Linux clients could then access this share through AutoFS. Now, the reason being, the reason why we use the AutoFS is with traditional NFS, if a machine had gone down or what have you, you'd have stale NFS handles with AutoFS. Hopefully, if you were finished utilizing that particular partition, a timeout mechanism would take place and unmount without issue, and then be re-engaged once you got there. So this was on the file server side, ran the df-ht ext4, and came back with the 5 terabyte partition. And on the client side, just cd autofs research file system 1, ran the df command, and there you go. We're off to the races, and the researchers were engaged putting the data, you know, onto the system. But they permitted me time. I think it was about a 14-hour window to get the data from backup onto that data store so that they had an initial point of to go back to relaunch their code. So that was good. I'm going really, really fast. I'm sorry. So this talk might end a bit early or prematurely. Future work. Things are always in flux. How many of you have made use of RAM disks? Just yourself? 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, 5? Okay. So I was looking at, instead of using a traditional file system to house my diskless image, I was thinking about putting it on a memory disk and sharing that out. There might be a performance penalty, but it's not too bad. I was cheating a little earlier. You may remember that the specs for the backup servers indicated 4 gigs of RAM. With that ZFS volume brought in with LZ4 encryption or compression enabled, I actually put a 20 gig swap file on it. So I was getting the benefit of the RAID 6. So this might you know, allow me to quickly engage other operating systems, but it's kind of hit and miss. The other thing with the Zen server, you'd have to hack the startup scripts, but the clients themselves are limited to 100 gig full duplex, even if your server has gigabit capability, so it's actually downgeared, but you can hack that. There's some documentation on the web so that your Zen clients could run at full network capacity of that actual host server. Now, I had talked about earlier implementing RAID 6 and RAID 5 and what have you. When talking to Peter Hanstein yesterday, about some data center configurations, one thing that came to mind was if I had the ability to have two disk stores and both were running iSCSI targets for whatever client, maybe it'd be best if I had created similar iSCSI targets on each and then used Linux's RAID 1 array to pair the file system. Then in the event that either back-end server were to reboot, my system would still be functional. So that's another strategy, but it's a little bit of overhead. But you get the benefit of the RAID 6 behind the scenes plus the RAID 1. So you kind of almost have full redundancy throughout the data stack. The other thing, when dealing with a lot of the diskless FreeBSD stuff, and you have the conf directory populated with your various clients, my thought was to try to abstract out the diskless version client conf file, and then overlay that using UnionFS or something along those schemas so that the conf files could propagate a lot easier going forward with a distribution upgrade or patching or what have you. And then the other aspect is it would be nice to rectify that off-site backup scheme so that I had more than one backup. I had kind of a primary and a secondary. So if we could procure more resources, we could invest that for a better backup window on the back end. So questions? Yes, sir.
SCSI disks with truncate to create files.
Yep.
Why didn't you use Z-Rolls?
That's a good question. Why didn't I go with Z-Vols? That wasn't what I had found when I was first looking down that road. I was, you know, why not give it the actual volume itself? I felt that if I turned off the iSCSI daemon, I could then take that particular file, do a ZFS snapshot, and shove it off to a remote server. Or a secondary server, and bring that up.
You can do that with
too. Yeah, with the snapshotting. Yeah, yeah. This is the things that you find after, and you're like, oh, I wish I could go down that road, but unfortunately, at the time, that was the entry I went. Any other questions? Okay. So thank you all from the conference attendees, BSD CAN, and support staff. I greatly appreciate your time.